Good evening, James McKenney here with my Science Hour. This is for May 3rd, 2018. And tonight I'll be talking, have some health topics, also a little bit about education, a little bit about electricity in India. Interesting story there. I'll be talking a little bit about the polarization of the Earth, basically the populations of the Earth, and how polarization is causing a lot of difficulties when we live on a pretty nice, unique planet. But at any rate, polarizing is a method that is used by foreign powers, basically, and it's a way of corrupting a country from within. So, in other words, taking issues and making sure that people go to extremes. And so what you do is you don't create a one or two-sided polarization, you create a 50-sided polarization, so there's no unity. And people cannot come together because they're polarized on maybe one or two or three or four issues. And anyway, just talk about that a little bit. So first of all, towing icebergs from the Antarctic, South Africa is running out of water, and not only South Africa, but a lot of other places in the world. I've seen in this past week many stories about either poisoned water, insufficient water, poor management of water, etc. But to understand the water issue, actually, in most places, there's plenty of water. But if it's a one-way street where you use water and then do not recycle it, and you put so many pollutants in it that you couldn't possibly recycle it, then you have a water problem. So the South Africa is, they're saying that within the next year, they will simply not have water. You'll turn on the faucet, nothing there. And this is the kind of water, this is volumes of water, not just drinking water. So there are some people that have come up with a solution. They believe that towing icebergs from Antarctica up to South Africa would be a solution, and then they could melt it, and this would produce huge amounts of water. Well, that's a good idea. There's a possibility, however, that ice, once you got down into the ice a bit farther, there could be viruses, and viruses from times past. Let's just take a look at this. Imagine that you have ice that formed 10,000 years ago, or 5,000 years ago, or 2,000 years ago. And we know that, this is based on my work, Venus produces viruses, the swine flu. My work explains why this happens. It's because in the comet tail, in the electric field, as molecules and atoms come in form, they have a rich environment in which to form. In other words, Venus, although we think of it as a planet, it has a large comet tail that extends out beyond Earth. And in that tail, viruses are forming. And what are viruses? They're basically large conglomerations of the basic building blocks of life, which are the nucleotides. So they form in not really random formats. There's a basic structure that they would form in, but the end result is that these then come down into our atmosphere. The first to be affected by this are the pigs. And this goes back to the Chinese. Chinese recognized this in 1200 AD. And then it mutates. It is then taken up by the birds, especially the chickens. And the bird flu is a transformed version of the swine flu, and then that's what the people end up getting. So it's the swine or bird flu, as they call it in China. but it's associated with the inferior conjunction of Venus. But imagine now, we're dealing with viruses that come in today, in today's world. But imagine that there were viruses somehow that possibly formed in a passing comet that Earth encountered maybe 100,000 years ago. We don't know. The point is, in that ice, there could be viruses. And once those viruses get out, they could be communicable. And if that were the case, you would be dragging in basically a Trojan horse. It's assumed that ice is clean water, and it's really not true. It's full of dirt and soot and material that fell in from outer space, because that's going on all the time. And how do our water systems deal with this? Well, they are basically refreshing themselves at least on an annual basis. So the question is, can you drink this water? Now, there's something that people do. They actually freeze water to kill bacteria, but it does not kill viruses. Viruses can live through this. So that's one issue with hauling icebergs in from Antarctica. Now, I've proposed this, and I've proposed also harvesting the rivers of water that are flowing off into the ocean off of Antarctica, and also the Arctic, the North Pole, and Greenland, vast amounts of water, but you should filter it and also have a UV process that would kill any viruses. So this is an okay idea, but also we're looking at energy. Now, I did my World Energy Water Project. I did 13 or possibly more episodes in my paid cast on this, ending in March of this year, dealing with energy and water. And my conclusion was that no matter what your source of water, it needs energy. So now you're going to attempt to pull an iceberg, which is not, you know, a little, it's got a lot of drag, it's got a lot of it's not going to be an easy thing to do, to drag an iceberg up to South Africa. It's going to take a lot of energy. So they're talking about actually price tags and getting this funded. And this is being done by people who are used to doing large projects. So all of my best, you know, that's a good idea. But there's a possibly an easier way to get water from Antarctica, and that is by putting it in large bags. Now, there's a gentleman, I think he's from California. I forgot his name offhand, but he's developed basically long water bags. They hook together, and you can pull those. But my idea, coupled with this, was to use the wing generator to use wind power to pull these water bags. And the reason the water bags are better is, number one, they're easier to handle. An iceberg, remember, what you see above water is a fraction of what is below water. So you have to displace this water continually to move it, and water bags float. They would be floating on the surface of the water, and they'd to move the same amount of water, it would be much less resistance. So energy-wise. But then, of course, you got to formulate or manufacture these plastic bags that are no small task. So neither one of these solutions is what you'd put in the category of easy. And in either case, there's potential for viruses in the water. So you have to take care of that. You have to filter it, and you have any source of water you should be filtering. And that's just, I don't care if you live on a pure mountain stream coming out of the mountains. And the reason being, and I found this out when I was young, I thought, wow, springtime, you can drink the water right out of the lake. And in the springtime, you typically can. But as the summer progresses and animals, a lot of times moose or wolves or animals like that, their solid or liquid waste products, bodily waste products, get into the water, and those can spur things like worms or small bacteria and little amoeba type animals, basically. And if you get those in your system, they can be very damaging. They can make you sick. So, and that's up in a pure mountain stream, because all it takes was a little bit of pollution, and if you call that pollution, but it's something your body's not going to do well with. And so you have to filter water. That's my opinion on any water. And I've spent part of my life in the wilderness where all I had to drink was the water from the lake with a cup in my hand. But that was typically up in central Canada from the central part of a lake that was still very cold. And basically, I didn't have any problems. So anyway, this is a story that I'll probably be following, because I might be able to help with some of the solutions on how to move this. And maybe they'll have to move the first water with steamships or oil-driven ships. But as time goes on, it would be nice to be able to carve these blocks into a streamlined shape and then use wind power with the wing generator to directly power them. That's a topic I'll be covering a bit more in the future. Okay, there's a story on cold fusion. If you're not familiar with this topic, this is something that keeps popping up in the news. And there's a group that claims that they had some success, and they don't even really know. This was published in Extreme Tech Magazine. The concept of cold fusion is you have basically hydrogen. And we know that from burning in the sun, it creates a lot of energy when it fuses. So that's the term fusion, as opposed to fission, which is breaking apart large atoms like uranium, plutonium, etc. But fusion deals with the small atoms, hydrogen, deuterium, helium, etc., at least in the practical range that humans would be able to manage. The concept is with cold fusion is that there might be a way to do this without having the hydrogen at high temperatures. In other words, this would be relatively warm temperatures. And so there's another group that thinks they have the catalyst. And now that's the ticket. People have been using or trying to find the catalyst reaction that would speed up the process, that would make it occur at a lower temperature. This is a common practice in chemistry where you find one element that, and I'll be talking about another story here in a minute, relative to the creation of electricity using water and hydrogen. But this story, they believe they found a mechanism, and they really don't even know how it works yet. And it's being reviewed in some peer-reviewed literature at this point. But they showed a cell, it looked like it was heated up, but the levels of energy they're getting out of this are not commensurate with nuclear fusion. In other words, what they might have is a very hot chemical reaction. So time will tell, but I, as well as everybody else, very cautious whenever it comes to the term cold fusion because of the famous case of Pons and Fleischmann, two chemists who were working in a laboratory. They went out to lunch, they came back, all of their equipment was melted down in the laboratory, and they thought that they had achieved cold fusion. So they went out and they put it in the newspaper, and they made a lot of publicity. And it turned out they couldn't duplicate whatever happened there. They could not duplicate it. So it they were scrutinized. They couldn't really come up with a duplication. Nobody else could duplicate what they were doing. And so they really lost a lot of face. They were ostracized. And so any claims of cold fusion today are met with a lot of skepticism, and rightfully so, because it's like anything that hasn't been done yet. And it's a physical process that we actually know happens. I have my own view of that, and I've actually published that. It's dealing with, first started with Jupiter and Saturn when I was at Cornell, I realized from the Voyager data that there was fusion going on in the atmosphere of Jupiter and Saturn because of the proton wind. And so that led to the my statement that fusion is going on in those atmospheres. It's a cold atmosphere, certainly nothing like the sun. And so it's the electrical discharges and the pinch effects that would cause the high-density magnetic fields that are needed to bring the atoms together. And once that process starts, it's like any fire. It's an electrical fire, and then the fire creates the lightning bolts, which keeps the fire going. So in a, let's just imagine a chemical fire, a wood fire. You have a pile of wood, you come in, you put a, and here's a good example of an accelerant or a catalyst would be like, say you pour kerosene on the wood to get it started a bit faster. That's a good example of a catalyst where you light that and then that burns and the kerosene eventually burns off, but the wood is left and that starts the wood. It gets the fire hot enough to get the wood burning. And or you could just start the wood with little pieces of tinder, what they call tinder, broken up little sticks and pieces of dry grass, etc. You light that, and that gets the fire going. And the end result is that the energy stored in the that was created when the plant grew now is at a high temperature is accepting oxygen and converting in to carbon dioxide and other gases that are given off, primarily carbon dioxide. And then the carbon-based ash that comes off of that is the solid residue from the plant material. Okay, well, in this case of fusion, you have the hydrogen burning and you end up with larger molecular structures, but giving off a tremendous amount of heat. So the question is, how does this process continue? And I think that the big accelerators, what they're trying to do is they create what they call magnetic bottles. A magnetic bottle is a very highly concentrated magnetic field, which they try and contain the hydrogen atoms that come in at high velocity, at high energy, and try and contain them long enough to kick off the fusion reaction. But typically they have not gained over unity. In other words, it takes a lot more energy to create whatever they're doing than they get out of it. So that's the trick. And of course, hydrogen is the most plentiful element in the universe. So finding a way to ignite it into a hydrogen fire would be a boon to energy. I'm just wondering, though, if we already use way too much energy, would it turn into another human nightmare? I don't know. But anyway, that's a story I'll be keeping an eye on. I'll be following that to see if, in fact, they have, you know, any conclusive evidence of producing cold fusion, or if it's another one of those stories that, you know, it's too good to be true. India in the news. Now, what was it, 2015, the president of India, or whatever, the premier, or whatever his title is, made a statement, and at that point, of the nearly 600,000 villages in India, now this is not talking about major cities. India has over 600,000 villages. And typically, they're out kind of in the middle of nowhere, and they have not had electricity ever. So his statement was in 2015 that he wanted to electrify the entire country of India, giving all of these little towns electricity. So it's very interesting, and just the other day he announced that he had achieved his goal, and the last of 18,000 towns in India have now been electrified. And you think, ooh, that's amazing. So the last approximately 20,000 towns, can you imagine a country that has 1.2 billion people and just a huge population, but trying to provide electricity to that many people. But their criteria, this is the interesting part, their criteria was that one in every household, one out of every 10 households, one out of every 10 schools and hospitals, etc., would be provided with electricity. And so literally what they have is they have a line that comes into the town, to the village, and a transformer. And if one-tenth of the people in that town have electricity, they consider it electrified, in other words, connected to the grid. And now it's up to the local people to connect their own house to that transformer. And I just can imagine, I've been in places where they have, for example, water. And each individual has to go up to like a water tank or a water main or whatever and run their own personal water line down to their house. Well, some of these runs can go for miles. And so you have the duplication, basically, in that case, of hoses, and or in the case of electricity, the duplication of electrical wiring. And but anyway, that's their criteria for electrification. One in every 10 houses has electricity. And I'll tell you something, too. The electricity is probably for a light bulb, one light bulb in the house, probably a refrigerator if they're lucky, and then a television set, and maybe some type of an outlet where they can plug things in, like a cell phone. Because in third world countries, the one thing that almost everybody has is a cell phone. So, but anyway, that's electrification in India. But also the power is very unreliable. So even though that transformer is there, that doesn't mean you have 24/7 power, 365 days a year. You may have intermittent power. It's probably a lot of brownouts, possibly surges. And more than likely, most of those 600,000 towns are struggling with the level of service that they have. So anyway, this is just trying to imagine the scale of a country like India, where, you know, 600,000 villages, 1.2 billion people, trying to manage so that they have just the basics, food, you know, first of all, energy, water, food, living conditions, and not just water, but clean water. And then also water for agriculture. The hand labor there is like most third world countries. And, you know, so they, I heard some statistics from a gentleman I know that he's from India, but he said they're looking at water resources, and they considered that 1 to 2 liters per day per person is sufficient water. And by the World Health Organization standards, the minimal daily requirement of water per person is 5 gallons. And so if you take that times, you know, the number of people in the world, of course, in the United States, etc., you know, 5 gallons, that's one flush of a toilet for some people. But, you know, showering, laundry, you know, in the kitchen, all of the water requirements that people have in the United States, they use a tremendous amount of water compared to third world countries. And so imagining that you would get by on 1 to 2 liters of water per day. And now in some cases, this is not clean water. This is non-filtered water. This is not water that you would last very long drinking, let alone bathing your kids in it or whatever. So just gives you an idea of the stress level of these overpopulation centers. But I was thinking the other day about this topic, and you think about the United States and you think, or Europe or what you call first world countries. But if there were a stress event on Earth where the infrastructure collapsed worldwide, where electricity went down, who would be the people who survive? And that brings up the question of survivability on the long term, given, you know, ups and downs in infrastructure and food and energy and water. And the first world countries are so dependent on their infrastructure that they really would not last long if there were a major earthwide catastrophe of some kind. And they, you know, to replace the transformer, say, in the U.S. power grid, it would take possibly years and years simply because they're not available. They're not, there isn't a warehouse someplace that has, you know, 10 or 15,000 transformers of the type that you see down at the end of your block, the final transformers that bump the voltage down to 220, which is then delivered to your house. So it comes back to kind of a survival of the fittest type of things. And, you know, who is the fittest? What defines the fittest? The first world country with all their infrastructure, or the third world country with their lack of dependence on infrastructure and their ability to live without it as a normal course of life, everyday life? So time will tell who will be the survivors, who's going to overcome adversity. And it's a topic that requires a lot of thought. And that's why, by the way, I've told people in my lectures, I tell you, you know, we've gone through the so-called Planet X scare, and that was very interesting. And really, the way it ended, it just kind of all fizzled. You don't hear really anybody talking about Planet X before anymore, very little of the hype. But that's because I believe it ended when I made the conclusion that the nucleus of Hale-Bopp was literally what Harrington was looking for, and that's where it all started. Fairly complex story. But the disinformation stories that just flooded everything for years have ceased, and you don't hear about it anymore. And I think it's not a topic that raises, still people are interested in the topic, but not like in the mid-2000s, for example, or when it began the early 2000s, when supposedly the world was going to end at one time. And good grief, probably 20% of my time on air, radio, etc., interviews, probably 20% of my time was dedicated to dispelling all of the crazy stories that had come out. Anyway, and I do talk about that a bit in my April paid cast, where I talk about my books. And just a little segue here, my book, for example, Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes, recounts my work going back to the late 1970s, where I was talking about comets becoming planets, the big comets, and the capture mechanism for development of the solar system, and that Planet X was literally any object that had not been named yet. It transformation from large comets into planets, and not all of them become planets. In fact, very few become planets. Hale-Bopp is an object that is in the process of forming a planet. It's not been literally captured into the solar system or brought into the plane of the planets, etc. So would you call it a planet? No, it's a comet. It's a pre-planet formation. So when I talked about Planet X, and when I wrote my book, Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes, I was talking about the general term Planet X. I was not talking about some object. And I reference, of course, Nibiru and Wormwood, the biblical references. And, of course, the next book out of the chute was the Atlantis to Tesla book, which exposed the concepts given in the Colburn, in Atlantis to Tesla and the Colburn, Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn connection. I discuss the history of the Colburn, which talks about multiple big objects in the solar system at one time, multiple big comets, and not becoming planets, just big comets that did a lot of damage in the solar system, etc. So Planet X is a term that I use to discuss my work that went that had gone through decades before this public disinformation campaign that was started by the CIA in the mid-1990s with the advent of Hale-Bopp. It was commensurate with the advent of the public discovery of Hale-Bopp, which was July 23rd, 1995. So anyway, I'm just discussing why I used the term Planet X in my book. I wasn't talking about a Planet X. I was talking about the general operation of the solar system and trying to dispel the idea, the crazy stories that came out throughout the 2000s. And then there were all of these wannabes. Every 2 to 3 months, there was a new yo-yo coming out that had claims of having researched this for 30 years. Oh, my goodness. Looney Tune Bill. And wearing a baseball cap backwards and just goofy, repeating all of the same hack lines, which I proved didn't make any sense. But probably 20% of my time was spent dispelling those. And then they tried to lump me in with, you know, the ding-dong crews out there, the disinformation crews, when I was doing more to dispel the idea of the crazy lady talks to aliens. I was spending more of my time, or the whole laundry list of other wannabes out there that took those topics and ran amok with them, or the Mayan calendar, the 2012, or the 2000, the end of the world. Remember that the millennium bug in computers, which was another fake story. Good grief. And most of that has passed. Now we're dealing with some other issues, but all of that craziness seems to have subsided. Thank goodness. So going back to my book, Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes, it's a discussion of how the solar system works, the electrical nature of comets, how they can affect the planets, including Earth, and the putting the story of Velikovsky into perspective when we did have a planet that was formed from a comet, which became the planet Venus, and the physics of how that works. That's what my book was about. Not about, you know, crazy lady talks to aliens, you know, and anyway, so a little bit of a side note there. But here's an interesting email that was sent in by a listener, and it made the comment that it started out by commenting that a particular university was going to raise its tuition. And some of the universities now are quite expensive. I made the comment, Daniel Brigman, once a couple weeks ago, last month, I think, I was guest on the Power Hour, and he said, what about education? And I said, what I recommend to students is when they get out of high school, go to a third world country and live there for a while and learn how the rest of the world works. And then I said, you know, take in your high school years, start a business, maybe an internet business, or develop a product, or develop a talent, or whatever you're going to do, but start a business someplace in high school. Some kids could start earlier and become an entrepreneur. And then when you have enough money, go to college. And I should put a caveat on that. If you're in the hard sciences like physics, chemistry, biology, and mathematics, then you would want to go straight to college from high school, or from college to grad school if you're going to continue in grad school, because breaking the chain is difficult. I did it, but I maintained my skills when I was off for a couple years before I went back from my college, graduated, and then took 3 years off, basically, and came back. That's when I ended up at Tulane University to get my advanced physics degree. And I kept up on my math and my other stuff because I was teaching it and traveling, and I went to, you know, I kept up on that. But most people probably would not, so they'd lose their edge. So I'd recommend for the majority of students, unless you're really disciplined, that you should continue if you're in the hard sciences, physics, math, chemistry, biology, and continue into college, continue right into graduate school. And it's tough. It's tough going to school for that length of time and keeping your focus. But at least if you're normal, and most people end up actually being a bit abnormal because they're in school too much. You know, the Google-eyed student, you know, that doesn't know anything else is unfortunately a bit too common. But anyway, this person wrote in, email, and said that the university was raising its rates and that parents have decided that the cost of university is not worth it. You know, if you're spending $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year on tuition and you multiply that by four, that's $250,000. That's a chunk of change. And so is the job that junior or daughter is going to get when they get out of college worth that much money? Are they going to be able to, you know, because most people don't have that kind of pocket change sitting around, so they got to take loans. Is it worth it? And a lot of parents are deciding, no, you know, it's not worth it. And probably students too. I mean, you could take that money, start a business, and then, like I said, take the profits. If you have enough money, then go back to school. And I was kidding with Daniel, kidding but not kidding, that at that point, you have a business, you are making your money, you have not created a glass ceiling for yourself with a college degree, and then go back to college to party. Because that's where all the fun kids are. That's where the people are that you know, to party or whatever. And I'm serious about that. That you should go to college also for the social life. And unfortunately, college too many times becomes advanced babysitting, where kids go and they just party and they really don't advance personally. They come out 4 years later kind of the same mealy-mouse personality, really haven't, they don't know what's going on in the world. They think they do, but they really have no clue. And, you know, college can be advanced babysitting is what I'm saying. But I got in a little trouble when, in fact, this is just one of the issues I got in trouble for when I was at Cornell, because when I went to college, it was very rigorous. The physics program that I was in when I was a freshman, I went into the first class physics school. It was a small private Christian college for at the time for men, no women in the college, and it was pretty strict. And there were 42 potential physics majors in my first freshman class in physics like 101, you know, basic Holliday and Resnick physics. And the professor came in the room and he looked around. He said, look around. I counted 42 people. And he said, by the end of this semester, there will be 10 or less of you. And everybody was like, oof. And I thought, oof, oof. You know, and when the end of that semester came, there were 9 of us left. All of us graduated. All of us went to grad school. And that was the program. It was a pre-graduate school program. And of the 42 people, well, 33 of them were not there at the end of that first semester. And so the school, after I graduated, I went back and visited one time, a number of years later, and one of my professors talked to me and he said, you know, the college came down on us. They said, we cannot justify the small physics department for the amount of expense, because physics costs more than, say, economics. The economics, they go into a classroom, there's a lecture, they leave. Physics, we got laboratories, there's a high volume of space for each particular student. We every one of us had our own office there. And so, in laboratory, et cetera. So there was a lot of expense. So they opened it up, and they started using the curve, in which everybody except the bottom couple had to pass. And he said the quality of the physics program just nosedived. And so anyway, that was just one of the comments. But when I got to Cornell in, 1979, I was in a laboratory setting, and the professor was very proud of it. It was in electronics, like it was a mid-level electronics course in the physics department. And I criticized him because there were bins, like a 2 foot by 2 foot bin. And the students would come in and they'd take their equipment out of their bin. They'd go into the laboratory, set it up, take their measurements, and they'd have like 2 hours for the laboratory. And then they'd put all of the equipment back in their bin. But the wires were cut to length, everything was there, the right size rheostat if they needed one, or resistors or transistors or whatever it was, they were all there. And when I went to school, I had to figure out what size wires I needed, and I had to go cut the right length and understand the resistance and the voltage and the current so that I didn't burn up the wire when I built my experiment. And I had to pick the right resistor or rheostat or the transistors. I had to pick the ones or tubes that we even had tubes when I was in college. And, you know, I had to choose all this stuff. Or we had a machinist on site that did machining. We built our own experiments, etc. So that, for me, was a learning experience. So when I got to Cornell and I saw this, everything was in a little bin with all the wires cut to length and the right size and everything was there, I said, this is not a very good learning experience. These students are not learning, you know, all of this stuff that would go along with, you know, learning, you know, basic things like what kind of wire should I use? What size? What current capacity? You know, and so I got in a little bit of trouble for criticizing this professor. Anyway, that was just one of the things. I was never very good at being subtle. I always, if I saw something, I opened up my mouth and said it. And when you do that in life, well, sometimes you're not the most popular guy in the department, like saying that comets were not dirty snowballs, something totally unheard of in 1979, or that there was electricity in outer space and here's where it came from and this is the data that shows it. Anyway, enough of that. Interesting story talking about electricity is the Stanford University has announced and that they had discovered a new battery process dealing with water and magnesium and manganese dioxide as a chemical. And so they're taking what they call carbon. It's like a pad. It's like, imagine a Scotch Brite pad that, you know, you buy at the store to scrub your dishes. It's that little green pad, and it's kind of made of fibers. So they made a fiber pad out of carbon fibers and then coated it one side with manganese and the manganese dioxide, etc. And so anyway, I'm not going to go through all of the details here, but they claimed that they found a process for storing energy, electrical energy, and then basically releasing it, which, of course, is a battery. And now they got 20 milliwatts of energy that they can store in an exchange. And so, of course, everything has its beginning. But this is what I found interesting, that they imagined that the cost of this would be less than $100 per kilowatt hour. Now, a kilowatt hour, if you get your electric bill at the end of the month, your power usage, your electrical power usage is measured in kilowatt hours. And typically, in the United States, if you're hooked up to the grid, you're probably around 10 or 11 cents per kilowatt hour. That's kind of an average. You might be a little more, a little less, but that's about an average. So 10 cents per kilowatt hour, and the Department of Energy, in their oversight of these industries, have decided that $100 per kilowatt hour, if you can devise an electrical storage device, in other words, a battery, that you can store energy and then retrieve it for less than $100 per kilowatt hour, then that gets into the realm where they would take serious note of it. But let's look at this. Say you could create a battery that would reproduce, you could store energy and then get it back for 10 cents a kilowatt hour, and that's the price of electricity that you pay to the power company that provides you with electricity. Well, still, that's not a very cost-effective battery, because now you need solar panels or wind generators or some other device that generates the electricity to create the electricity to store in your battery. So to actually have it useful, you have to get on a large scale. I'm talking about the kind of scale that you would use across the country. And this would be based on basically a laboratory salt that's very available, manganese, and that manganese dioxide, I should say, that is relatively available, so that potentially could bring the cost down. But the actual cost for a large scale would have to be a lot less than 10 cents per kilowatt hour, because you have to get other equipment to provide the electricity, and you have to bring that in. So to compete, this is the point, to compete with the central power company, and what we're talking about here is alternative energy, you would have to get the price of your storage facility down to maybe below 3 cents or 2 cents or 1 cent per kilowatt hour, because you have to pay for all this other equipment that goes along with it. So anyway, I just found that just struck me as interesting that the Department of Energy had $100 per kilowatt hour, which is really a big number. That's like 1,000 times the current rate of electricity and 10,000 times the rate that you would have to have a usable device on a large scale to cure our energy problems. And so the fanfare that comes along with this and the publicity, I don't see that it's warranted at this point. If you could get down to a dollar a kilowatt hour, then I would say, okay, now you got a shot at bringing this down to, you know, some kind of reasonable value, because then you got a factor of 100, which still is a big jump, a factor of 100, but a factor of 10,000, it's not something I'd exactly write home about. But anyway, just to make this announcement there, and we find all the time that there are battery technologies. There's the carbon, what is it, the C6 battery technology. I see all kinds of stuff people send to me. And, you know, the reality is that they're going to have to do quite well to compete with, say, the lithium-ion batteries that are out there. It's a proven technology. We know what the parameters are. We know how, you know, the manufacturing processes. All of these things come into play. So just because you have a some kind of chemical process or any kind of process doesn't mean that you can mass produce it for mass markets. And also, I found it interesting in the Chinese claim. Now, these are Chinese students and a professor at Stanford University, which is another thing that I always had trouble understanding, is the volume of foreign students in our universities. That basically, well, anyway, that's a whole other topic. But to compete against current technologies, and then in this announcement say that they think that this could be charged and recharged hundreds of thousands of times, which is way beyond the life cycle of, say, current known batteries such as lithium-ion or the lead-acid batteries, which are popular, like in your automobile, or deep-cycle lead-acid batteries, to make a claim when they have built one little teeny model, have used it a couple times, and gotten 20 milliwatts of energy out of it to make a claim that somehow this could be used and recharged up to capacity 100,000 times or some large number is there again. This is pure speculation. This is wild hopes. It's certainly not based on any scientific reality. So at any rate, it's a story that I'll keep following, but I'm definitely interested in battery storage because of the wing generator. But I'll be honest with you, having entered into the world of real products, creating a product that's manufacturable and marketable from a theoretical concept like the wing generator, for example, is a task, because you're dealing with engineering, you're dealing with physics, you're dealing with theory, you're dealing with current technologies that are supporting technologies, etc. There's nothing easy about it. So people sitting in ivory towers in universities making wild claims, I don't think it really helps anybody. They should simply state what they have, and then if they think it's going to do 100,000 cycles, then they should be doing 100,000 cycles. Just a quick note, I noticed one of my other notes here for the show today. There's an article that came in, and I don't have access to it right now. It's called Glyphosate in Food. I'm going to be looking at that, but take a look at that, because the studies now in the United States and elsewhere are finding glyphosate in food. Now, glyphosate is another term for Roundup, which is the basically the spray, the Monsanto herbicide that is sprayed in corn and soybeans, etc., and it's working its way into the food chain, and even the UN has declared it as a carcinogen, cancer-causing agent. I'm going to turn my attention now to, here's a story about a plasma physicist from Germany. His name was Professor Karl Rauer, born in 1913 and died just a number of days ago in 2018, 105 years old, a couple days before his 105th birthday. But he had a long and extensive career studying the ionosphere. And so he was already aware of the ionosphere around the time of World War II, and understanding radio wave propagation and the ionospheric medium and the stratification in the ionosphere. And he also was one of the first people to understand and predicted the ability of high-frequency communication using the ionosphere, in which case some of you are listening to me by this technique, where shortwave radio, it bounces off the ionosphere and therefore travels around the world. So my voice is able to carry, because of the this understanding produced by Professor Karl Rauer, R-A-W-E-R. And so this is very interesting, because after World War II, then he became part of the French studying. He actually started a French institute studying the ionosphere, and gained international reputation, etc., and set up worldwide measuring tech stations in Italy, Greece, and North Africa, other places. He also was instrumental in forming the geophysical year and studying, you know, with scientists around the world, and eventually had a gold medal in science named after himself, after his work, and in his honor, there was a gold medal in science. But in the 1950s, of course, we entered the world of rocketry. And so he became involved in this, and he became chairman of the German National Committee of COSPAR, which is still in existence. And the understanding of the ionosphere and outer space and also had communication internationally between the East and the West, even during the Cold War era. So anyway, it led to a greater understanding of the ionosphere. But the point is, the point I'm trying to make here, and I could go on listing achievements that he was instrumental in working along and creating the groups that studied this. But imagine the PhD he gained when he was a young person, back in the, let's say, it would have been about the early 1930s. So imagine the state of science back then, and then he lived science, basically, throughout the ages, living to a ripe old age of 105 and still working at that age. So this is something, I mean, I hope I can do this. I hope that I'm going to be live to a ripe old age and continue working and be able to pursue my research, which actually I'm doing a lot of in the background right now. But the idea is that the PhD that you get, or the degree that you get, is of course in the year that you're dealing with science that's relevant at the time. But all of that can change. And that's one thing that's really a problem in science today, is that too many people are stuck in scientific concepts that occurred when they got their PhD 20, 30, in some cases 40 years ago. And they have never gotten out of that rut. And, things have progressed a lot, and it makes it very difficult for someone like myself to work in the scientific world, because you're dealing with people who are, stalled. They're stuck in a rut. They don't understand new processes. They're in charge of creating satellites to go out into space and create the experiments that would be performed, when they really don't have a clue how outer space works. But at any rate, here was a person that was a pioneer that changed the way physics worked, and even in his old age probably did not understand all of the technical aspects of how the ionosphere worked because of the lack of understanding of electricity in outer space. But just interesting to note that my point is that the PhD one gets, and relative to the information that's available, and this is the same in electronics, electrical engineering, computer technology, and on and on and on. Okay, well, I'm about out of time. Just want to remind you that my water filters, JMCC water filters, the best filters on the planet. My paid cast is available, $3.95 a month. And all of this information on my webpage, jmccsci.com. This is Jim McKenney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.